Good evening. Welcome to the Slurry Report. Today is January 22nd, 2015. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Well, it's been a busy week. We're off to a very volatile and violent 2015, as I said in the wrap-up. The PDF for the wrap-up will be ready next week. We'll have it up in the transcript section, also in the blog post, and so you absolutely want to take a look at it, and it's very helpful to see the material in that form. We're also going to be publishing booklets, which will be available at cost to the subscribers, so stay tuned. Our theme tonight is Markets Matter. The Swiss proved that to us last Thursday, and they sent the currency markets on a wild ride, which is not yet over, and the reverberations were still sending waves through the market. Even today, when the ECB finally announced their QE plan, obviously the Swiss move in anticipation of what that would do. The Swiss did absolutely what was necessary. They were spending billions defending the peg of their currency to the euro, and the costs were escalating as the money poured in. Literally, even though Swiss deposits and sovereign bonds were operating at a negative interest rate. And that'll tell you sort of the fear in Europe at the time. The market was very surprised, which is a good thing. It means the Swiss had not prepared their central banking counterparts within the G7, including the United States, is my guess. If they had, there would likely have been leaks. But again, the message is that markets matter. When enough market participants are afraid, then they're going to shift their funds into currencies and jurisdictions which respect property rights and have sound fundamentals. So the peg, there was no way the peg could hold. And the market knew the ECB was going to debase and had to deal with its debts, and the Swiss don't have to debase and deal with their debts. Their only challenge is how do they keep tourism and exports going in the face of such a strong currency? But in the face of the flood of money coming in, the Swiss had to let the currency float. And it's a reminder that supply and demand matter no matter how political the environment. Money and markets, top story of the week is, again, the ECB announced their QE to start in March. Supposedly, it's a $1 trillion plan. There's much of how it's going to be done to be worked out. What they say is they're going to start bond buying beginning in March. It's going to amount to 60 billion euros a year. That's approximately 68 billion U.S. a month. So it's a significant amount of money. They say they're going to run it until September 2016. That means all throughout 2015. So this is a long period. A lot of the purchases will be made by the participating central banks within the different countries, or that will be held. They say they're going to buy in proportion to the capital contributions of the different countries. So, for example, Germany has 26%. They say they're not going to buy anything that is not of investment-grade assets, but they are going to be purchasing on behalf of the different countries. And if you look at Greece, et cetera, their bonds are below investment grade. So it'll be interesting to see how it happens. Greece still has to hold elections next week. So we're going to see the outcome of whether there's any chance Greece will drop out. I think the chances are still good the European Union holds. But that doesn't mean you can't see one or two of the southern countries exit. What we have now seen is first the U.S. doing quantitative easing, and then as they begin to taper, Japan picks up and does quantitative easing, and now we're seeing Europe pick up quantitative easing. I've often said that there are two ways you can deal with a debt. You can mark down the debt, or you can crash up the equity markets, and that's to a certain extent what we're seeing with quantitative easing. We're watching bonds be bought in. I said I thought the Fed on their quantitative easing had bought the bonds in, was literally shredding them, despite what the ECB has said. It wouldn't surprise me if the same thing is going on in the ECB. They're taking bonds off of balance sheets that are valued at principal But at market, they'd probably be worth something far less. So I think they're going to relieve the bank of a lot of potential defaults. And as they do, you're going to see more and more money headed into real things. So it's going to go into stocks. It's going to go into real estate. It's going to go in precious metals. And those will continually be revalued up. If you haven't read the Planet Equity section in the wrap-up, I really encourage you to do it. Because what we've been watching is the size of the equity markets rise. If you look, the fixed income market is significantly greater than the equity markets. But if you continue to do QE around the world, particularly in the G7 central banks, at some point you can add enough money to the equity markets so that you can literally grow them. I said I thought the equity markets, which are now about $70 trillion, could grow another $60 trillion in the next 10 to 15 years. But if they keep this up in perpetuity, that $60 trillion could get added much faster. I know there are many commentators who believe that any kind of incredible monetary excess of this type is going to lead to hyperinflation. I don't agree. I think you've got a number of factors. Labor deflation with globalization is very powerful. It's part of what we're all feeling here in terms of income. And so I think labor deflation is very much offsetting to monetary inflation. Also, information and automation technology is having a dramatic effect and is going to have a much more dramatic effect, I think, over the next 5 years. And finally, securitization is a process that's soaking up a lot of those dollars as well. And so it's all part of this, you know, corporations running things in global 3.0 as opposed to governments running things in 2.0. Think of it as the corporate takeover of the planet. The European ETF was up about 0.6% today. It's not a lot. The market has been anticipating the ECB QE, and so it's been rising for the month, particularly over the last week. Let's see what the Greek elections do, particularly if there's any indication that Greece seriously might move out of the European Union. Mr. Global clearly wants centralization, and the European Union is cognizant of what they have to do to compete with India and China. And those two things, I think, are going to make a great contribution to holding the European Union together. Essentially, top-down risk management right now is more powerful than populist anger. Now, while the ECB was busy announcing their plans to increase inequality, the global leaders were at the World Economic Forum in Davos. You've been seeing a lot of press about it. They've been wringing their hands about growing inequality, fueled by a new report from Oxfam that pointed out that the top 1% now have increased their wealth from 44% of the world's wealth to 48% in 2014 and are expected at the current rate to pass 50% pretty closely, which means that they own as much wealth as the least well-off 80%. Who currently own just 5.5%. So it's quite a comment on the consolidation of wealth. And, of course, the quantitative easing is just going to continue to exacerbate that. If you sort of look at the conversation at Davos, they're much more worried about appearances than doing anything significant from what I can see. And I think part of it is that if you are – a political leader or a leader in the kind of positions they're in, it seems to be an overwhelming task to try and change the system, one, because of the complexity, two, because of the global rebalancing, and three, because you've got a very centralized Mr. Global who has a very clear picture of where they want to go, and you're in the middle. So I think everybody feels a little bit helpless and that they're in a prisoner's dilemma, which is why I think a global conversation about what we need to do to build real wealth that happens on an out-of-control basis is so very important, and I want to be doing more of that this coming year. Anyway, I think the other problem is for the European leadership. They have many different elections this year, and I think the tension of European elections and then U.S. elections the following year. Just throughout the G7 between 2015 and 2016, you got a lot of people in the middle who are not quite sure how they're going to handle the elections because there's a lot of frustration and anger. The president of Ukraine had to leave Davos early. He came and then left right at the beginning because things militarily were not going well. The Ukraine is in a serious financial and economic implosion that's likely to get much worse as winter continues. The Ukraine is now in default of the Chinese in addition to the Russians, and there's no signal that the IMF intends to solve their problems, at least anytime soon. So we may see what a real economic collapse looks like in the Ukraine this winter. The Russians continue to dig in response to the falling oil revenues and Western sanctions. I posted a great commentary from Dr. Farrell on the blob. Take a look. One of the things that happened is the Duma is now considering legislation to ban NGOs, which is fantastic. If you look at the whole strategy by the Americans with using financial and economic sanctions combined with NGOs, the so-called soft revolutions, all these not-for-profit groups inside your country, you know, sort of pointing out every mistake you make and how inhumane you are. It's a lot of the pot calling the kettle black. But you have all these caring, heartfelt young people running around being used to point out how terrible you are. So the idea that the Russians should boot the NGOs, I find very charming. And they continue to work with MasterCard now to team up with a Russian central bank on payment systems. So if you get independent payment systems, if you get independent satellite systems, if you get an independent space program, if you get the NGOs out of your country, you're really moving towards self-sufficiency. And again, the Russian consumers and private sector have significant foreign debt, but the Russian debt as a percent of GDP is one of the lowest, if not the lowest, in the world. The interesting thing, Farrell put up an article where he talked about one of the conversations we'd had, and this is the one I posted on the blog. Putin's in a very interesting situation because most of the leadership in the G7 are essentially appointed by Mr. Global. They may run in elections, but they're really chosen by the committee that runs the world. And Putin is a little bit different. He really does have bottom-up political power. And so he has the power, you know, he literally is the only sovereign government, in a sense, in G7, in that sense. And so he can deal as a principal, not just with the other sovereign governments, but he can deal as a principal with Mr. Global and the people on the committee. So he's in a sort of unique situation. And as I said in the wrap-up, I think essentially Mr. Global is using Putin to really speed up the building out of the hardware and infrastructure for a global currency. And but it's very interesting to watch what he's doing and how he's doing it. Back in the U.S., we had the State of the Union, which happens in the January after the after Congress reconvenes. I don't watch these things. I much prefer to read the detail of what's been proposed. Most of what the president proposed is dead on arrival politically. It almost makes you squirm to read him talking about helping the middle class when so much of government budget and investments and enforcement policy is organized to literally destroy the middle class. You know, so when the president says, here are the things you're going to do, you feel like screaming, why don't you just stop doing all the things you're doing to destroy the middle class? I put up a chart on the blog this week that shows that the last 40 years of economic productivity have gone. In fact, none of it has gone to labor. And I can't tell you how important government violence and violent enforcement has been to achieve that. It's made a major contribution. The thing that was most Orwellian, and here's a man who's saying he's trying to help preserve the middle class, and he proposes taxing 529 accounts. Are you absolutely nuts? One of the most important things you need is for students to get a college education without student loans. And the idea of taxing 529 accounts, which are college accounts, is just, it's absolutely absurd. The average balance in a 529 account is $20,000. So you're not talking about the top 1% here. Anyway, so it's so Orwellian, you hardly know what to say. Big question this year, I think, politically is going to be how hard the administration pushes for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They clearly want it very much. I suspect it's important to continue support to corporate earnings. I know they'd like the European trade deal. I think that one is tough given the European elections and all the sort of fluid problems in Europe this year. But it'll be interesting to see how much they push for Trans-Pacific Partnership. Coming into the State of the Union, one of the things we saw was Attorney General Eric Holder announced that they were cutting off the provision that allowed state and local police to adopt the federal process for asset forfeitures. This is a very important and interesting signal. The interesting thing about it is they're cutting off revenues to a group that they're now sort of beating down. So they don't need to make friends with the local police now that they're targeting them. I think it's also a very important signal in a variety of ways. It's certainly if you're the president and you're going to talk about stopping harm to small business or helping the middle class, one thing you can stop doing is seizing their money when you have no evidence of any wrongdoing. So it's sort of something you can do, and it's something you can give the body politic, and it doesn't cost you a lot of money. It costs, you know, the people now that you're beating down, so it costs the local guys money. So in that sense, it's very clever. But I think it's a signal. We've talked about this over the last couple weeks. The Economist had a very important editorial saying the American enforcement system has gone too far, and they need to back off because they're destroying the trust that is the basis of the economy, which I think is absolutely true. But then, of course, the question is, if you look at who the Economist sort of speaks for, I'll tell you what I think is going on. I think that you need an enforcement system that has a lot of thugs in it when you're trying to build out the system to control. Once you've built the system out, the thugs become a liability. So you don't need an iron hand. You need an iron hand and a velvet glove. So now that they've got the iron hand, they've got the system built out, they need a velvet glove. They need to be able to reach out and seize and do whatever they want quickly. That's part of the iron hand, but they also need the system to have credibility. And right now, it's sorely losing credibility. So if you look at who the new AG is, I think the new AG is somebody who's designed to put us through a phase of wrapping the velvet around the iron hand. But it's time for the thugs to go, and this is a very clear message that the system is in for a big change. And so I think that's a very important signal for Mr. Global. The biggest U.S. story, I would say, of the week is Google and Fidelity announcing that they are investing $1 billion into SpaceX, SpaceX being Elon Musk's space company. During the wrap-up, I put up a video of him speaking at MIT, the one where he warns us about artificial intelligence, very good and appropriate warning, but he also describes a little bit about what SpaceX is up to. He's the guy who said, and he's very committed to building colonies of humans on Mars. He said, I want to die on Mars, but not on impact. And his big contribution right now is he's trying to build a reusable rocket, which is very important to the economics of space travel. Anyway, big question, of course, is who's really investing through Fidelity. This may not be Fidelity. This may be somebody who has their money managed by Fidelity. But we have seen since the beginning of the year, and I talked about this in the wrap-up. I keep stressing it, but we've seen an outpouring since the beginning of the year about stories of the search for new suitable planets, announcement of more planets found, more interest in building colonies on Mars. There's just a regular drumbeat of stories. So the message I'm getting is that Mr. Global is impatient and pushing hard, whether it's the Putin game to build out the global infrastructure for a global currency or more stress to get out there looking for planets. You kind of wonder what's really going on. But to me, there is a real speeding up of the effort to build out a two-planet civilization, two-planet or more. The oil card, oil's still down. It's in the 40s. The consolidation in the oil patch now that Christmas is over is accelerating. the independents are really getting clobbered by these prices. So we see, for example, an announcement of Kinder Morgan saying they're buying a lot of a big partnership up in North Dakota. So we're going to see that kind of consolidation. We're seeing gas prices drop dramatically at the pump. I had somebody report to me this week $1.57 a gallon in Oklahoma. Got a call from Los Angeles of somebody trying to tell me about $1.62 from Los Angeles. When I came through Los Angeles in November, it was $4. That's quite a drop. So this is a huge relief globally to consumers and to those countries that depend on imported energy, including oil. So big boon to China. We see the China stock market up, continue to rise. Very strong for the last year, but very strong this year. So big boon to China and Japanese. Saudi Arabia, of course, losing revenues from it, but today they lost the king. King Abdullah died. He's been reigning since 2005, one of the most powerful people of the in the world. So this is more changing of the guard. He's going to be replaced by his half-brother. So let's look at the market. Gold broke the $1,300 line today. It's 1350 is a very important line, so don't be surprised if we hit resistance there. But it continues to be the strongest part of the market for the year-to-date or so far this month. Let's just go through the market and look at everything. So gold up 9.9% year-to-date. That's 2% for the last 12 months. TLT continues to rock. That's the 20-year Treasury ETF. It's up 5.6% for the month. You keep wondering how high can it go, but it looks to me from the charts it could go a lot higher. Chinese market is up 4.1%. That's 25% for the last year, so they're the strong stock market. The 7 to 10-year Treasury, the intermediate Treasury, is now up 5.96 for the last year. The corporate bond aggregate, 1.2. So it's interesting. Treasury is way ahead of the corporate bonds. The S&P is still down about 0.5% for the year, but it's moving up. Don't be surprised with the ECB now pumping if it closes up for January, but probably just barely. U.S. dollar not skyrocketing the way the Swiss franc is, but continuing to climb. It's now 94.166. And we see the big swing is the VIX move down, signal of volatility moving way down to dropping by 10%. It was really rising on the fear. So a report from the Wall Street Journal, venture capital was up 47% in 2014. Expect that to continue. You see a lot of money flowing into the new technology. Nobody wants to be left behind. Everybody's piling into Global 3.0, and there's a lot to be done. So expect that to remain high. A lot of money in private equity, you know, small companies never getting to market or getting to acquired. So the smart money is moving in early in private, and I expect that process to continue. More corporate debt boondoggles with interest rates just this low. They can lock up tremendous amounts of long-term capital at very low cost, and I think they're all going to keep doing it. So there's big debt issuances slated, so that's going to be good for the investment bankers on Wall Street. Oh, boy. And under the category of you thought you had a bad year, up on the blog, the one fund manager who started a hedge fund at the beginning of the year with $100 million had to send out a newsletter to his investors apologizing. He was down to $200,000. So can imagine, start with $100 million and lose everything but $200,000 in 1 year. That's a bad year. Our hero this week is Thomas Jordan, the president of the Swiss Bank. Great job. No leaks. Face what needs to be done. Take the Band-Aid off fast. Markets matter. Okay, ask Catherine. I am going through your movie list and wondering if you can help me. While I prefer documentaries for factual content, which of your suggested movies deals with the drug wars as it relates to your insight and experience? I would say I'd go a little bit off track to understand the drug war because it's so related to the black budget and the need for cash in the black budget. So I would watch all the videos we provide on the blog from the Secret Space Program Conference. I'd watch them first, and then I'd watch Godfather and Kill the Messenger in the Let's Go to the Movies Salieri report I did with John Rappaport. He has one that he helped make that has some good footage. And there's also good footage in Guerrilla News Network Crack the CIA, which I believe is on the list. But I would start with a deep understanding of the black budget issues and the hidden system of finance. Then the question goes on. I noticed that the two documentaries that I regularly suggest about chemtrails are not on the list and curious why. And he mentions What in the World Are They Spraying, produced by Griffin and Murphy. And Why in the World Are They Spraying, directed by Murphy. While I've not seen Kill the Messenger about Gary Webb, why is it not on your list as well? We just had on the list the movies that we I reviewed in Let's Go to the Movies. We didn't include the movies that I've done special commentary reviews on the blog, as well as the movies that John Rappaport and I covered in our review, our special Salieri report on best movies and documentaries. And what I should do is add a section to that list and include all of those as well. So Kill the Messenger got a special review in a commentary on the blog, and then Murphy and Griffith's movie, both movies were reviewed on the blog, but Griffith and Murphy's movie was documented the year in 2012, along with Jeffrey Smith's Genetic Roulette. So I agree with you. Those are both really terrific. The next question is long, so I'm not going to repeat all of it, but points out the importance of having curriculum and suggests that we, based on the conversation that I had with Farrell about the importance of preserving and learning a variety of different things, could we make suggestions about curriculum for things like science and business and entrepreneurship? Great requests and comments. I've been looking for curriculum, and it's not an area I know a lot about. One of the things I would suggest for the business side, it's critical that your kids have great math skills. So I would start with math. I have a piece that I wrote for my pastor who once asked me for a curriculum for high school students for economics. It's called Economics 101, and if you haven't taken a look at it, you can just pick it up on a search. It's in the article section. But I will go ahead, and as we focus this year on helping young people, I'm going to start looking for really good curriculum on business and entrepreneurship, and I will do that, and I'll keep encouraging Farrell. One of the things I've found is that writing curriculum is a very time-consuming and expensive endeavor, from what I can tell. I'm certainly not an expert at it. And so doing this is stopping to do this is it's hard to, as an economic matter, as a business to do it, but I think it's very, very important. Dear Catherine, when Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers in 1971 and the mainstream media printed the information, I'm assuming they did so with the blessing of the powers that be. Is that correct? Yes, I believe so. Although I would say things were less censored then, but certainly I think Ellsberg had support from certain quarters. And if so, was this all dictated from on high as a move to begin bringing down the Nixon administration? If this is true, then why did the powers that be want to bring down the Nixon administration? I've never researched closely. I do believe that the sort of the same people who knocked Kennedy off were instrumental, including the intelligence agencies, in bringing down the Nixon administration. One was he was doing a series of things, including on the war on drugs, that interfered with the black budget flows. So I always thought that was a piece of it, but I'm not expert at that. Then a question from a subscriber. How much of the Salieri Report is Catherine, and how much is a group effort? If Mr. Global locked Catherine away in Guantanamo, what would happen to the Salieri Report? I think if I got locked away in Guantanamo tomorrow, I have to say, I think the chances of that are very de minimis. Mr. Global has other things to worry about. But if I did, I think that if you look at the provisions I've made for what would happen to the Solari report and my death, I think the archives would certainly be made accessible for what I would hope would be a long time. But I think the production of new Solari reports would be would stop or be limited. And one of my goals with our new Vision 2020 for the next 5 years, after we launch the blog, I'm going to be really focused on building the Solari report out in a way that it's far less dependent on me is what my goal is. But I should tell you, because I tell all the people I know, that we have an absolutely fantastic team. It's a tiny team, but pound for pound, they're fantastic. So I'll brag on them, and I think they can do a lot without me, and they do a lot without me. The other thing is, you should know my retirement plan. I plan on working until I'm 86, and then I plan to read for 10 years. If you ever saw my den, you would say I've got most of the books stacked up already. Let's go to the movies, and let's go to the movies. We chose as our movie this week The Equalizer, which is a new action thriller from Denzel Washington. I was saying to somebody today, you know, I like anything if it has Denzel Washington, Kevin Costner, or Russell Crowe in it. But if you like action movies, and I do, I love them. And if you like Denzel Washington, I do. This is a, you know, in terms of entertainment, it's a great action movie. It's got great classic lines. One of the best, you have to see it to appreciate it, is Washington saying, gotta be who you are in this world, right? No matter what. Anyway, you need to see to appreciate it. It is absolutely, the reason I chose it and wanted you to see it is superb propaganda, complete propaganda. The thing that's amazing to me is when Hollywood can combine something that's absolutely great entertainment and acting, superb cinematography, and then just stuff down your throat, just the worst kind of propaganda in the world. It's quite amazing to see them achieve both of it in one movie. I'm always amazed at the artistic talent that it takes to do it. But let me describe the propaganda. Sex slave trafficking is always big to sort of target your enemies in the soft revolution, and it is here. Here's the good guys. The good guys are the intelligence agencies and the Boston Brahmins. Those are the good guys. The Russians and the local police in the U.S. are the bad guys. Remind you of anything, you know, targeting Russian sanctions and Ferguson hit on the local police. As I said, sex slave trafficking is always used to run hits. A perfect example is the Liam Neeson movie Taken, which is kind of a hit on the French and Eastern Europeans. The Americans are brilliant at using sexual politics to kind of, you know, target the enemy. As soon as you land in Afghanistan, suddenly you have all the women's groups coming in and helping free the women from the Muslim culture. It's quite clever how they do it. When it comes to sex slavery, though, it's really the pot calling the kettle black. So I assure you, the Americans are great at attacking everybody in this issue at this point. Someday, somebody's going to make a great movie that outs the Americans on it. One of the most interesting things to me about the movie is Edwin Hopper is an American painter who's got a very famous painting called Nighthawks, which is the painting of the great American diner in the evening. And there's so much of the cinematography that is positioned around Washington's late night trips to the local diner. And it's such a play on Nighthawks and the painting Nighthawks that it's so clever the way it's done. Anyway, so if you're interested in outrageous propaganda combined with great entertainment, check out Denzel Washington and The Equalizer. The interview with John Rappaport is fabulous. I wanted to have both Dr. Farrell and John help me chew through the wrap-up because it's such a major piece of work for us to do every year, and this one was very important. And of course, John, we have look at the most intimate ones because there's a real issue. We're going to be in a very noisy environment. It's got a lot of, there's a lot falling apart. There's a lot coming together. It's important to see both. But it's also important to sit back and say, look, how do I have a free and inspired life in all of this? Because we really have to take time and be disciplined about making sure that we are restored, revived, and have love in our lives. So we have to nurture ourselves and think about that anyway. So I really appreciate John joining me to do that. So check out the interview. Closing, we have some very great stuff coming up. The State of Europe with John Laughlin and Dr. Catherine Albrecht back about spy chips. I may run State of Europe next week. I'm not sure because we're interviewing John tomorrow, and it's going to be very timely. And then February 12th, William Bergman, fantastic economist, absolutely first-rate economist. He was at the Federal Reserve and got booted out for reporting suspicious transactions in connection with 9/11. Can you imagine? Lots of experience in the brokerage community as well. Very knowledgeable about the economy at a deep level. He and I are going to be talking about the power of financial transparency to build new wealth. A very important topic and very interesting topic and a very talented man. So I'm excited that he's going to be joining us. So until next week with either Dr. Catherine Albrecht or John Laughlin on the State of Europe, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.